The opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. I should also warn you that the language in this week's addendum is a bit strong. Just wanted to give you a heads up. Enjoy the program.
D-Wack is here with Undisclosed, the killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'll be joined by my co-host Marsha, who is an assistant professor of history and African-American studies at Georgetown University. She's a scholar of African-American life and culture, as well as a national speaker on social movements past and present, including Black Lives Matter. She is the host of Office Hours, a podcast where she talks to students about the things that are most important to them. We also have Wesley Lowery, national correspondent for The Washington Post, where he covers issues of race, justice, law enforcement, and politics. He has been the paper's lead reporter on Black Lives Matter protests and was a member of the team awarded the 2016 Pulitzer Prize and George Polk Awards for national reporting for their coverage of fatal police shootings. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. It's a really, really great book. I think that, you know, you guys should really go out and get that. Monica Bell, who's a Climco fellow and lecturer on law and PhD candidate in sociology and social policy at Harvard. As a lawyer and sociologist, she studies policing, police community relations in the context of poverty, and the intersection of police regulation with race, family, housing, and social services provision. She has conducted research on mothers in Washington, D.C., and the interactions with police, parents in Dallas, Texas, and how they think about police conduct when they decide where to live, and youth in Baltimore, Maryland, in the wake of the Freddie Gray incident, among other projects. And we have Jessica Jackson Salone, a human rights attorney who began her career representing California death row inmates and their appeals. She now oversees Dream Corps, hashtag Cut50 initiative to end mass incarceration. Jessica currently sits on the Committee for Fair Judiciary Services and Advisory Board, member of the American Constitution Society Bay Area Chapter, and represents Congresswoman Jared Huffman on the Democratic Central Committee of Marin. In November 2013, Jessica became the youngest ever elected official in Marin County, where she was elected to the Mill Valley City Council. Jessica became the mayor of Mill Valley in November 2016. How you guys doing today?
Good.
Excellent.
Marsha, I wanted to start with what we call the pre-uprise, before everything actually happened, because I feel like that part of the story, and you guys covered it well, but I feel like it didn't really get enough attention. There was a gathering at the War Memorial Plaza, and it was peaceful, and you know, it wasn't really a lot of activists there. It was more people from East and West Baltimore who had really no real history of activism. So it wasn't like some of the big names that pop up when you talk about organizing, but it was just a bunch of upset people, and you know, we all met there because we didn't really know what to do. And from there, we marched to Camden Yards. We marched downtown because I'm guessing, you know, most people felt like that's the part of Baltimore City that most of the people with money cared about. And mm-hmm. It was there where we were confronted by the baseball fans, but we didn't actually approach the baseball fans. The baseball fans approached us. People were chanting, no justice, no peace, no justice, no peace. And they started saying, they were drunk and they looked really angry. And it was just yelling, we don't care, we don't care, we don't care, which, you know, I felt like is the truth that they get to live with.
So in terms of kind of the point that you just raised, I think it was really important for me in directing this episode to start this story kind of from the beginning. And if you ask me, where does this story start? I would say April 4th, 1968, in terms of thinking about the way that Baltimore has managed unrest and the various dynamics at play in cities in the past, you know, 50 years that have not been resolved. And so I think that confrontation that you capture, I think it tells you everything you need to know about the pockets of Baltimore that have had the capital investment and get the protection and get the concern, and then the people who are left behind. But you're absolutely right. When people think about April 2015 in terms of Baltimore, they're probably thinking of all of the things that were, you know, on loop essentially on CNN. But what we wanted to do is really to tell a fuller story of exactly what you described, people who were frustrated, who were upset, who were really hurt before they even found out that Freddie had died. They knew that something bad had happened. happened to someone in their community. And they went to the Western District. They made a very public show of saying, you know what, we're not going to let this go unnoticed. And so I think that it's really important to really talk about the fact that people were concerned as soon as they got this information. And it was local people who were really instrumental in asking some very important questions. Someone that we have in the episode, you know, she was out on the street, you know, 10 consecutive days with her son because she knew that every day mattered in terms of making sure that people understood that, you know, while one section of Baltimore may have thought that Freddie Gray was disposable, another section did not believe that.
So Wesley, how was the story brought to you? Like, when did you first hear about Freddie Gray? Was it before he actually died, or was it after, or?
I remember I was traveling and I was on a early morning connection flight. So I landed at DCA back from somewhere, and all the TVs were on CNN, and Freddie Gray had just died. And I was like, oh, you know, I'd heard about it. I'd been following the story a little bit. And then I saw this, you know, just kind of that moment the morning when he had died, where it was like, this is about to be a thing. This is going to be a moment. This is going to matter. Right. And so, you know, I kind of followed it from afar from the very beginning, in part because, you know, we've got, you know, the way it works at the Post is that, you know, we consider Baltimore and a lot of Maryland part of our local coverage, essentially. And I work for our national desk. And so I kind of stayed back while they did their thing. But as we saw, you know, what was initially dozens and then hundreds and then thousands of people in the street, you know, at that point, I'd spent a few years covering these protests. And so I said, look, I got to get in the car and go up to Baltimore. And so I started spending some time kind of just in the community, talking to folks, trying to figure out, you know, what this moment was like and what, you know, and why this was the line in the sand in the communities that have for so many years dealt with, you know, policing that is oppressive to them.
Yeah. So, Marsha, you were saying something else that I want to touch on, too. And that's something that I don't think we pay enough attention to is a lot of people, when I travel different places, and I know you guys probably get it, too. We hear the word riot. 68 was a riot. You know, what happened in Los Angeles after Rodney King was beaten was a riot. Do we really call this a riot? I mean, a couple $1 million in damage. Nobody died.
Well, it's funny you say that. If you listen to the episode, you notice I don't use that word ever. Because I think it, you know, like a lot of words, it starts to take on this racialized meaning. So unless we can talk, you know, after the Boston Red Sox win a championship, if we don't call that a riot, then I'm not.
That's a riot. That's a riot.
So I just don't like the word, because I think that to suggest that there wasn't any root causes and perhaps warnings and perhaps signs of something. But regardless of how we place it, I think you're right. This was not LA, and this was not, you know, Detroit in the 60s, and wasn't Newark, New Jersey in the 60s. But what is resonant, I think what we can see, is the ways that the narrative is allowed to kind of unfold without any kind of critical questioning. And that's why I really appreciate the guests we have on, especially Wesley, whose reporting has been so excellent in showing the dimensions of these stories and resisting some of the grand narratives that just say, you know, Black people are just so irrational. You know, why don't they just chill in these communities that are just so great for them? And it's ridiculous how much we have to, like, remind people what's at stake, but you have to in order to really change the mindset of how people react when there are miscarriages of justice.
Jessica here. I was just going to jump in and say, when you were talking about it in the beginning and laying out really the narrative of what it was like to be there that day, I think one of the most beautiful pieces of it was how organic all the protests began. You said in the beginning, you know, there wasn't really an organizer. Nobody was really organizing this. This was an organic uprising of folks who were just so shocked and outraged at what had happened and felt this so deeply within them that they took to the streets. And it wasn't a riot. It wasn't a violent disruption of any sort. It was folks out there chanting, asking for justice, asking for peace, asking that their pleas for help not be ignored and that their fears actually be answered. So, you know, we see riots all the time. We see people who jump on the back of otherwise peaceful, well-organized protests and marches. But this itself was not a riot. We've seen riots here in the San Francisco Bay Area, just even when our sports team wins the World Series, right? People took to the streets looting and causing all sorts of havoc. But you would never say that, you know, that taints the hope and glory of the people who are out there celebrating a win. Instead, they say that's just a bunch of looters who took advantage of a situation. And it's the same situation here. Even though this was a justice rally or a justice march, it's not fair to contribute the acts of the rioters who came along and caused chaos to what was actually going on, which was a beautiful moment.
I would even argue that some of the stuff that was reported about what happened in Baltimore wasn't true. Like, there's like a church that's like in East Baltimore where a building supposedly was burnt down as a result that has nothing to do with nothing. It's not connected to anything. Nobody was using it. Nobody goes there. And it totally made no sense. But it was like an opportunity where I feel like some of those things were just like overhyped. Some of the fake alliances, just some of the things that came from that. From the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West side be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, 14
already trying to ride. This is Monica. I wonder if in removing the riot language, like I completely agree with you that there was a lot of misreporting, there's a lot of mischaracterization of what happened and what was going on in people's heads. I wonder if this kind of semantic debate about whether we call it a riot or not, in some ways calling this a riot tethers it to other sorts of uprisings that have to do with reacting to injustice. And while it, of course, didn't have the scale or the same kind of intensity, there are people, I think, who would claim that we don't want to depoliticize. In some ways, calling it a riot tethers it to its political history. And I don't know if I'm fully in that camp, but I'm certainly sympathetic to that way of thinking.
I can understand that. I think you raise a very good point because there are ways that we can think about riots historically as effective tools of political organizing on the street. I guess my discomfort with it is the way it's used by people who are are not thinking about politics, who are trying to find other ways to basically say, you know, the savages have done this again. I mean, it's like the use of the word thug, whether it comes out of the mayor's mouth or whoever, it's so coded that it's hard to remember that it is tethered to politics. But I hear you, Monica.
Like you said, it's a coded term that signals to the listener, to the reader, to who, the consumer of the coverage, that you don't need to listen to the grievances of the people in the street because this is just a riot. This is just some unruly crowd of, you know, savages burning their homes, their own city down, right? It's this idea that violence is never an acceptable response to anything. And so therefore, if this response is violent, no matter what it's a response to, does not matter, right? I think it's a means of delegitimizing this kind of collective and democratic process of people going into the streets and voicing their opinion. Because again, so much of our media and so much of our kind of institutional conversations across the board, whether it's how elected officials interact with these stories, whether it's how the media interacts, or kind of our political chattering class, right? We all begin with this premise, and it's a political premise. It's not like we act like it's an objective or a neutral, but we begin with this premise that like violence is never okay under any circumstance. And so if you can make something sound like it was violent, or if you can highlight the violence as opposed to the other components, you can delegitimize this thing as something that should be taken seriously. And I think we've seen that time and time again.
Yeah, what's funnier than violence is never an answer when the police officers are the actual thugs in most of these cases, and all they do is police with violence. I'm sure you probably found some of that in some of your research, Monica, and some of the things that you've written about or some of the things that you cover when you talk about police-community relations in the context of poverty.
Absolutely. You know, so I did some interview-based research with 64 young people living in Baltimore, kind of all over the city, but primarily in West Baltimore. And what you'd hear over and over again is this is the way things have been done consistently. There's never any, you know, listening to us. There's never any concern about us. This deep sense of empowerment and I'd call it, you know, estrangement from the police and the state. People would specifically make reference, for example, to the mayor calling them thugs. It's just like another signal of this lack of accountability and a lack of kind of concern about their day-to-day lives and kind of who they are and their place in society. So absolutely, it's a consistent theme. And violence, the consistent violence is a big part of it because the violence isn't just bodily harm. It's also a signal of that ongoing detachment and not mattering.
So Jessica, you're mayor now. You're the mayor of Mill Valley now, correct?
Yes, mayor of Mill Valley.
So seeing all of these things, what do you think you can do in your position to kind of change some of the things that exist, or to be able to run your city in a different way? Because yes. Right now in Baltimore, I'll tell you, there's not really, you know, you know what it is. it's not pretty. I'll just say that.
Yeah, no, it's not. The community relationships are beyond strained in many cities across this country. We're really lucky in Mill Valley to have a great police department that has taken on a lot of the challenges of modern day policing and is working hard to build community relationships with everybody in our community. One of the most important trainings that I think any police department can have, and it's an ongoing training, is implicit bias training. I think it's so important to not only be hiring people who live in your community and who are all from all different neighborhoods in your community to the actual police force, but also to be making sure that we're addressing implicit bias. It's in everybody. It's in everything we do, in every interaction, but at least being cognizant of it and thinking through how you're reacting to situations and being aware of how you're handling people and viewing them all as people. We were having a conversation earlier about language, and I think that's just so important. It's something that I definitely work on in the criminal justice realm with language, how we're talking about people who have been accused of committing crimes, convicted of committing crimes, who have served time and are now reentering our communities, and the kind of, you know, relationships we're building with them and efforts we're putting forth to make sure that everybody in our communities, no matter what they've been through and what they've done, are viewed as human beings with rights, who are valuable members of our communities and have a lot to contribute.
The language is important. Like, I think that you should ban the police officers in Mill Valley from using the word fuck. All police officers in Baltimore, that's their favorite word. Like, and they use it in 37 different ways. Fuck are you looking at? Fuck you doing? Get the fuck out of here. Hey, fucker. It's like they don't have grandmothers or something.
Yeah, and that's something super important, is how you're talking. And we're lucky, again, in Mill Valley, that kind of thing, we don't put up with that. I actually am proud to say, you know, we've just invested in bicycles so that police officers can be out biking around the community, not just in their squad cars, sort of isolated, only interacting with people when there's a problem. We've got them out there on foot. We've got our police officers. We have our community service officer who's working in the high school, talking to the high school students, working on restorative justice program inside the middle school and in the high school to make sure that problems are being dealt with in a restorative manner that doesn't escalate to the point where, you know, people are being called for arrests and taken out of the schools. So there's a very collaborative effort going on in our schools between our police officers and the kids and the administration. And we want that same restorative approach in our community as well. And we want those relationships to be there. We want our police out there interacting, talking to folks in the community, getting to know each other, showing up at our neighborhood leader meetings. They're at all of our council meetings, you know, getting to know the folks who are coming out with issues and concerns. And I think that's crucial to any town being able to function in a way where both the community respects police officers and the police respect the community.
You know, Jessica, one of the things I think is really interesting about what you're saying is you started with talking about training, and then you blossomed out to talk about other sorts of structural reforms and deep community sorts of engagement, restorative justice, et cetera. One of my concerns about reform in this current era is that we focus a lot on training. So, you know, it's implicit bias training, you know, it's complicated in lots of different modules that one might use. So I'm not exactly sure what implicit bias training your department uses. But part of this focus on implicit bias suggests that the problem of that we're seeing with policing is a problem about what's inside individual officers' heads and not sort of deeper structural problems. So I think it's really important in the reform conversations we're having not to just say, well, if we train the line officers to not be biased or to not use the word fuck, then we're really making, you know, a bigger shift. That's important, but there has to be leadership from the top to really signal that these are things that are important. These are priorities that are going to be that maybe, you know, when we think about officer pay and when we think about different types of benefits and awards officers might get, that we prioritize deeper community engagement restorative techniques.
I don't know if training is like a one-time thing. I feel like the way training has been treated throughout the history of policing, it's just this whole idea of I'll do anything to get this job. So if this job means I have to act like I like black people for like a week while they bring in like two activists and like a white lady in some sandals to come in and to talk about like why you should be nice to everybody. And you know, I'll listen to them. I'll take the 20 question quiz at the end. I'll pass my sensitivity training and then it just goes away. And I don't really think that it's a one class, 1 week type of situation. I think it should be something that, you know, should be re-implemented throughout the course of their career.
I think that's absolutely right. And more than that, I would say that there have to be incentives for actually doing this good work in real life, because oftentimes what happens with training, one of the reasons that the one-time training doesn't work is that people get trained and they express all of these great values and they may even really believe them at that point, but then they start working and police departments have cultures and they assimilate to the culture that they're in. So there has to be something bigger than a one-time training to actually change police departmental culture and incentives.
And I also think that, you know, substantive training and education are all very good ideas, but if they're occurring in a context in which, you know, the devaluation of black life isn't only common, but it's profitable, then there's so much dissonance that I think a person who's even trained to believe certain things, they're going to be like, wait a second, what system am I in? I mean, I think sometimes if the training is really effective, the question is, will this person remain committed to being within a police institution? And so, I mean, not to be a complete pessimist about it, but I do wonder if there are ways that we can ask people to kind of spread the desire to reform police into other institutional ways in which, you know, suffering is reproduced, right? So if some of the energy then goes to the schools and then the tax policies and then resisting, you know, the current political climate we're in, so that we understand that while the answers don't lie in more policing, the problems are not solely a problem of policing.
Right. And I think it's up to city leadership to really set the tone for this. I mean, you can go to any city across America, look at their mission statement, look at their core values, their priority projects, and figure out pretty quickly where they are in terms of community relationships and building tolerance and respect for everybody in their community, which was why I was excited to champion the ordinance on respect and tolerance in our community, which also established a task force of marginalized people who have had a different experience than the majority of the community, either working or living there in what is a very segregated town out here in California, in the most segregated county out here in California. So I think it goes far beyond just the police department. It goes to city leadership to set the tone that they want to be an inclusive city and that they are setting people up across the city departments, whether it's the rec center, whether it's the fire department, whether it's the police department, setting them up to respect everybody in the community and put equal value on everybody's life.
One of the things that has made me really anxious about Project of Reform more generally is if we think back to when the White House Task Force on 21st Century Policing was doing its work, Baltimore, and specifically Commissioner Batts, was used as an example of a department that was doing things right, particularly in terms of thinking about addressing past and present injustice. And when you think about that, right, so the structural reforms that allegedly were put into place were held up as an example of what to do. I worry about that. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but clearly the structural reforms that were made did not even come close to dealing with any of the deeper problems of separation between the community and the police, and this kind of elevating the importance of not just respect, but true, you know, guardianship or something like that. I don't know. When they go to school, they got the pistol by their side. All hoppers gonna be ready when the enemy collides. Collect phone
calls daily coming from the other side. Gotta tell them bad. So, Wesley, what do you think as far as, like, your stories and your research? What do you think about reform, or what does that actually look like?
Sure, of course. And I think there have been some really good points made already. You know, and I would echo this reality that it's not just about one-time trainings, but it's much more about the culture of departments and the culture of cities. It gets back even to what you were saying about language that officers use sometimes. I think about, having had a lot of conversations with people and activists, residents across the country, and you hear stories of, it's not even just hearing the stories, you know, as a black man, I've been pulled over plenty of times and have not particularly enjoyed the tone in which I've been addressed, right? And I think about how for a lot of people, that level of disrespect at the beginning of a conversation, the beginning of an interaction is going to set the tone for the entirety of the interaction. And on top of that, it's not even always just about how you are interacted with. I think that that's sometimes what we forget in these conversations, or people tend to forget in these conversations, is they think that, if you're not directly involved in an incident, it doesn't help color your perception of the police. Well, no, if my mom gets pulled over, my younger brother gets pulled over, my grandma gets pulled over or stopped or questioned on the stoop, and an officer takes a tone with her or, you know, starts swearing at her, that's something that I'm going to walk around upset about for years probably. Or, you know, it's going to be thinking that I'm going to be worked up about, right? That the reality is individual interactions have a lingering effect across dozens of people, right? And so each of these interactions degrades and erodes the relationships. But beyond that, it's important, not just the respect element, but also the kind of secondary training, what these officers are being told at their lineups every day, right? You know, I think one of the big things is that you have these turns of phrases that officers pick up after the training academy. They pick them up during their lineups or in the patrol cars. You know, one thing you hear a lot is it's better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Essentially, catch a charge, go to trial, be judged by 12 rather than being killed. You know, this idea that officers are being indoctrinated with a belief that they're in a war zone and that the only priority is that they need to go home safe. And the reality is that clashes with a community ethos in which our officers are supposed to be protecting and respecting. And so I think that unless police culture can be eradicated of those types of turns of phrases and that type of culture, all the retraining in the world isn't going to necessarily help.
It's funny that police say that. That's like, you know, that's a phrase that has been thrown around in hip hop. It's like some of these cops even listen to rap music and still hate black people. It's so weird. Like, it's like that Do the Right Thing scene. Who's your favorite singer? Prince. Who's your favorite rapper? Magic. Who's your favorite whatever? Oh, well, they're not black. It's different. Like, no, it's really not different. Like, it's a crazy thing. We don't really get a chance to get real, like what real training would look like. We get rhetoric and we don't really get results. And then on the flip side of that, just to double back down on some of the reporting. And I know you saw that as a reporter, Wesley. I know some of you guys would like to chime in on this too. The cleanup. Nobody wanted to talk about the cleanup. After that first night of the, you know, some people call it unrest, some people call it uprise, whatever. After that first night, a bunch of us got together and we cleaned everything up. And that's not the part of the story that people want to hear. That's not a part of the story that gets brought up when we talk about these times. And it only adds to that destructive narrative, or that narrative that dehumanizes black people caught up in these types of situations. I mean, right after the cleanup, I had did like a news segment, and it was this guy, Dan Bagungio, whatever his name is. But I was brought on to talk about the cleanup. And you know how you, when you're doing like a news segment outside and you don't really see who you're talking to, and I don't really follow like conservatives like that, so I didn't know who he was. Like, I never heard of him. I just had like a little voice coming out of the earpiece talking about, you guys are thugs, you guys are horrible, you guys are this and that. And I'm like, yo, who the hell is this? Like, and then I saw somebody sent me a clip to the video, because I kind of spazzed out on him a little bit. And when I saw the clip to the video, it's like this little square head guy. And I'm like, yo, like, where do these people come from? I'm pretty sure this person hasn't stepped a foot in this city and has no idea of what we were doing to try to help the young people that next day.
I think what's interesting about that, you know, one of the things that we really wanted to talk about in the episode is that, you know, people were doing a number of things when they were out in the streets. You know, some people were praying, some people were cooking out, and some people were taking care of young people. And the thing that I think is interesting is, if you went on that show and you made really clear the effort of the cleanup, and let's say you could even tell us how many tons of garbage people picked up, and you could talk about all the cuddly stories, I think that the narrative is so entrenched that even with that data that counters the facts, that the narrative of people going crazy or people going wild in their own city would still permeate. And I think it takes a lot before people realize even how to
receive the positive information that you are providing, right? So when that night when Kwame Rose went off on Geraldo Rivera, you know, Geraldo didn't even have the ego strength to listen to what he was saying to him. I mean, he like literally could not do it. And so when you look at the fragility of some of these, you know, roving reporters, you not only appreciate the people who are trying to tell fuller stories, but you realize that information and data still can't capture their attention because their imagination is so consumed.
Yeah, that was actually like, Geraldo, was he really wasn't feeling that. And again, he's there to do a job. He's not there to talk about what caused the problems. He's not there to talk about the cleanup. He's not there to talk about anything positive. You know, we need more reporters like Wesley. Like, we need more people who have some type of proximity and care for these communities to tell these stories. And we don't really get that.
I think that a lot of these reporters struggle because they haven't spent time in these communities. They don't know real people who live in these spaces. I remember I was walking around the second or third night with a Baltimore Sun reporter, and we were watching all of the like national reporters and international reporters taking pictures of like row houses that had been boarded up for like years. And they're like, look what the riots have done to this community. And like, that liquor store has been closed for 3 decades. I'm like, that's never been that building's never been open. You know, and I think that so you have this like, you know, so here you are, some preppy white dude, you know, who graduated from some Ivy League school 5 years ago and has been working in New York at a newspaper or something. And you get flown into Baltimore the night after the riot and they're just scared. They don't know where they are. They don't know what they're doing, you know. And I think that you have to have people who, you know, I say this a lot, you know, part of the job of a journalist or a reporter is to be a translator, right? You know, I'm going into a place and I'm hearing the story of the people and I'm trying to translate it, that message and that story, the content of that message to a broader audience, right? But how do you translate? How do you explain something that you yourself do not understand, right? You have to understand it.
Care, right? You got to care.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you both have to care and you also have to like literally understand it, right? Like I'm not going to go out to drop into Russia tomorrow by myself and do a bunch of interviews with people and then send it back to the US because I don't speak Russian. I literally would not understand what they were saying, right? And I think that you have to have some familiarity, even beyond just caring. I think you have to actually know and take the time to know and understand and listen to people when they're talking to you. Otherwise, you're just making a bunch of assumptions and layering on your own agenda on top of, you know, you're using these people as pawns to advance your type of narrative as opposed to actually listening to what they're saying.
I think that point's really important that everyone is talking about these various ways of trying to solve this problem. And one of the things that I find so illuminating and frustrating when looking at the history of these moments is that if you go to a library and you check out all the riot commissions of major cities involving violence that is targeted towards Black people and the police get involved, whether it's 1919, 1968, or 2016, they name the same problems. Police brutality, few businesses, lack of media representation, rumors, and a lack of employment opportunities. Like, so over, you know, this long period of time, people will go back and have these debrief sessions. Well, what went wrong? And the same type of tactical errors that were made, like shutting down the transportation system, you know, letting this kind of culture emerge where, you know, people did not know what was going to happen and if the police were there to hurt them or to protect them when they were out in the street, all of those issues, like we've been down this road before. And it's kind of amazing to me when everyone does their, you know, Monday morning analysis, they're just brand new. It's like, wow, you know, you mean if you shut down a transportation hub, it causes problems in a moment like this? Or you mean if you know, starve a neighborhood of resources, people get really angry. I would have never known. And so I think that the kind of innocence and the faux naivete that comes out of these moments is sometimes really difficult to listen to because, you know, it does feel like Groundhog Day.
That's why I get so sick of the same story over and over again. Like I would, if it's one thing that we can do like together is let's talk about the real roots of some of these problems and why they continue to exist. Why are we saying the same thing over and over again? Like, and wanting to be taken serious.
Probably the more sinister problem in a Baltimore context would be that people see things but don't have the political will to really take on the root causes. And then there's the money issue. where do the resources come from to fully desegregate communities, to reinvest in them? There are resources. And so I totally agree that that's a priority. But like everything points in the direction of how this policing problem is really symptomatic of the bigger problem of dispossession, particularly among the people who tend to face the most police violence.
You know, we have people in Baltimore who wanted to stand up and go to court. And, you know, like Mr. Harold Perry, they wanted to speak out and they wanted to tell their stories and say what really happened to Freddie, but they just really didn't get a chance. And again, it's like, why? You know, if people don't want me to say, you know, if we're not going to sit here and talk about systemic racism or how that young man was dehumanized, if we can't say that, then, you know, I would just open it up to the other side to say, why? How come these people who witnessed this crime aren't able to come to court and say what they saw? And then people would say, oh, well, you know, there's a no snitching culture in Baltimore City.
Monica's the expert on debunking this fallacy. Literally, you're the expert on it. Aren't you, Monica? I think you are.
Well, I wouldn't say that. But, you know, again, it's like this tendency. And we have the same tendency with respect to officers, right? So when an officer does something wrong, we think, okay, well, the problem is this officer and these line officers and their kind of bad internal dynamics, instead of thinking structurally. And we have the same tendency with respect to this no snitching thing. It turns out that many people in their ideal world would want the police to work well for them. Even many of the youth I was talking to in Baltimore, you know, sort of like the concept of police in this sort of ideal world that is so far from their reality. And so it's not that there's like a stop snitching culture. What it is a broken system of criminal justice and multiple interlocking broken systems that are pushing us in this direction where people don't have a voice to, and they don't have the platform to be able to kind of tell what they know, you know, to share their own wisdom.
Yeah, it's just like all of these things are broken. None of these things work. And everyone points the finger at someone else. But I mean, I don't know. Is it just me? It seems so simple.
Well, it's simple. But then what does one do about it? Right. So like, I think the diagnosis is actually pretty simple. I am 100% on board with you with that. Like if you're talking to, you know, some politician or some bureaucrat inside the government, what policy change do you tell them to make first to deal with the problem? Now, I'm not saying that you know, I'm with you on this one, but I think that's the barrier. There's a translation problem between clearly identifying the issue is structural racism and structural disadvantage and saying, okay, here's step one in removing it.
I'll weigh in from the mayor's perspective here in local government perspective, and that's 100% correct, Monica. There is oftentimes a really good intent in why we take office and what we want to do, and sort of a bigger picture view, but actually figuring out the details of how you get there is very difficult. I've seen more and more sort of toolkits for local progressives, local electeds coming on the market, but I can't tell you how invaluable it is to actually have somebody who's showing you, look, these are the ordinances and the resolutions that you need to be passing in your community. Because oftentimes, you know, these issues are on the local level, and it's local level that has the least resources, but the most impact on the issue.
And I also think that one of the things we have to be really careful with public policy is the kind of all lives matter thinking in which policy is drafted and it should work for everyone. And then you start to see that it's impossible for the most marginalized. I recently did a talk about sustainability and racial justice, and someone was telling me, you know, what a great idea tiny houses are. They don't leave a big environmental footprint, and you can like repurpose them over land, and you can do them like in Detroit. And I had to say, well, that's good if there's only one person in a family. But if a family has three or four children, what are they going to do with a tiny house? Like, and I think that this person really was coming from like a good place, but like they could not imagine a world in which a family has a lot of children or a lot of children that they have to informally care for or elderly people or, you know, whatever the situation is. And I think that that is a really good example of the ways that, you know, it isn't just a matter of saying, okay, well, we are just going to make better policy. It's the assumptions about how policy works in people's lives that I think is really the challenge. And I do think is possible because we have really good information. And I think we have really good people who are willing to do that hard work.
Mm-hmm. How can I expect you to respond to the policy when you don't even know the difference between a knife that's legal and a knife that's not.
Ooh, wow.
It's like these people, I mean, beyond broken policy, it's broken people. Mm-hmm. It's a broken culture. Like, you know, some police officers are smart. They've manipulated the system for a long time. Some police officers are very, very stupid. Did you see this thing with this overtime case, right? It's like either you don't care or you're so stupid. So it's like, what are you – this is why I say, again, when I say we just need to, like, get rid of all of them and start over, I can't see anything. We need to start from the beginning. Like, we need to just start over again because what's in place right now is years and years. It's like a house with, like, a foundation – that got ate up by termites, and the first floor got ate up by termites, and the roof got ate up by everything got ate up by termites. But instead of us trying to add new posts or rebuild the foundation, we putting in like marble floors. Like, it just don't make any we still giving these people money, and it doesn't work. And again, like, you know, like I said, again, when I'm in these streets and I'm talking to people, they words like consent decree. Words like it never comes up. Words like reform, people not worried about that. Like, people don't even talk about Black Lives Matter. That's not a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a thing. A thing is like, you know, they against us, they harass us, they racist. If I needed them, I wouldn't call them. What are they there for? And then on top of that, for, you know, those of us that have jobs, we got to pay for that shit. It's like, what if you had to pay for, what's them little ugly, them disgusting candies that come out every Easter, Peeps? I feel like they free, right? Aren't they free? Do people sell them?
Yeah, they do sell them, D, but your point would stand.
Who's going to pay for Peeps, though? Like, when you pay for that, finances these police departments is like paying for Peeps. Not paying for no damn Peeps, but, you know, we don't have a choice. Like, you know, and then when we talk about the opportunity side of it that allows these police officers to function, like, we got bigger problems here. Like Al Mayer made a joke about minimum wage. She I ain't swear on the Bible. That shit ain't funny. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's not funny. Like, it's not a joke. So we have all of these different issues. And then when we talk about these issues, even we complaining or we not doing what we're supposed to do. And then on the flip side of the coin, we have these issues. And, you know, so a person says we need reform and they get a pat on the back.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make the police officers. Are we going to make all of them read Wesley's book? And then we're going to make and then we're going to make them read my book. And then we're going to give them Between the World and Me. And then we're going to pat them on the back. No, right. I mean, they can do that. We'll take the sales. But what I'm saying is that people scream reform, and then they just don't do anything when the reforms are so weak and so phony, and they have nothing to do with the community. And then we get back in the same situation.
So what do you think we should do?
Get rid of all of them because they don't do anything.
Abolish
police officers and start fresh. Yeah, we need to change the whole culture. Right now, what we have, it just doesn't work. Like, I don't – if these reforms take place, and I'm speaking for – I can't speak for anywhere but Baltimore City. I spent a little bit of time in Ferguson, but I spent all of my time here. And all I can say is this. If we look out 5 years later and, you know, the police department is doing what they're supposed to be doing and it's working fine – and, you know, they're out really, you know, doing their jobs and protecting people and, you know, all people, then I'll find you and I'll tell you I was wrong. But I feel like I heard this song and dance before.
So, I mean, what, if anything, would you have in its place? Like, would you have kind of community members doing patrolling or like what would the ideal look like for you?
So I don't think that if we didn't have a police department, I don't think that people would run around and steal and murder and do all types of things. Like, I don't really think that would happen. I think that we can insert some sort of community policing initiative as we make the transition. But I just think what's there, it just needs to go. Like, we need to get rid of all of it. Even if we started out with the brand new applicants and started moving them in, while we move the other cops out, because they're just not, like, it's just not working.
I think the other part of the issue, that makes it a problem is that the services that police provide, probably there's a good chunk of them that shouldn't be provided by police.
Absolutely.
So if someone is having a mental health crisis, perhaps an armed individual isn't the person to come deal with it. And if there is, you know, child abuse in the home, maybe it isn't the way that we address it is by, you know, bringing in a police officer necessarily in that home. Or in some cases of domestic violence or certain types of interactions between citizens, maybe a police officer isn't the person to bring in to diffuse. And I think that part of why this is a problem is that communities don't have the resources to get a lot of needs met. So right. The first responder are the police. And so that, I think, is something that we could probably see some type of ground being built around that concept. And I think also, I mean, the secondary issue is there's an expectation that people are to respect resources and services that they pay for, but that don't treat them as real citizens. So why would they? And so there's this, you know, the narrative that emerged about the CVS. I mean, the CVS was such a centerpiece to this narrative, and the deep woe people felt over the CVS, and this question of why is a CVS fulfilling so many needs in a community? Like, that's a problem. If a drugstore, a single drugstore, is doing all of these things, then it's telling you that there are a number of things that aren't happening. And so I think that with poor communities, particularly poor communities of color, there's too much consolidation of resources and needs being met by institutions and services that shouldn't be meeting those needs in the first place.
You know, I 100% agree with that. And that's something I've done some writing about in the past. I guess I'm curious about the police abolition aspect of things, because that's always kind of the place you're not supposed to go.
Let me say, I'm biased because I've never had a good experience with them. So I don't really see value in it. I pay for it. It's never good. You know, I don't see value in it. Might be a bit extreme, but it, like, when I see them, I don't think, every time I see them, I think problem. I don't ever think like, oh, good, the cops are here. So this is going to be swell. Like, I never think that. Like, I see them and I think something fucked up is about to happen, and it's mainly because they showed up. So, you know, maybe they are out protecting somebody in some other community, and it would be a bad thing if you got rid of them there. But I'm just talking about my own experiences dealing with them. Like, I only see bad.
No, I hear that. Yeah. And I think that that's reflective of a lot of people's experiences. I meant just sort of, Mike, in terms of policy space, that's the thing you can't say, right? Like, you can say a lot of things. You can say, you know, they're doing too much. You can say it's always bad. But the thing you can't say is, why are they here? Let's get rid of them. Because then it's like you cross over into some other sort of space. And it's always, you know, well, what would you replace them with? Who, you know, there's always this assumption that people would then therefore kind of run rampant and commit crime. So I guess that's the fundamental distinction, like whether you think people will run rampant and commit a lot of crime in the absence of police. And that's a real, that's a challenging question.
Well, that's why we don't, you know, this is why we don't legalize drugs, right? Because if we legalize drugs, everybody's going to turn into dope fiends, right? I mean, that's what they say, right? Right. But we see it doesn't happen when it doesn't happen when they do that at different countries. I just like I'm just saying, like, I can admit to be biased because people say, well, our cops aren't bad. And I'm like, yo, where they at? Like, where they, you know, you mean the guy who took the picture playing basketball, hugging a crying black kid, or the guy or the police officer who jumped on the basketball court? Like, where is he at when, you know, his friends is beating the shit out of somebody that I know? Like, where's he at? Like, I don't. Joe Crystal was one of these, you know, supposedly a good cop. And he saw his fellow blue members doing some things that they wasn't supposed to be doing. And he, you know, he reported it. And then when he needed them for backup, they wouldn't come. When he needed help, they wouldn't come. When he needed, like, somebody to, you know, go with him to the donut shop, he couldn't even get a donut buddy. So now the donut thing didn't really happen. But he basically got ran out of town. So I'm saying, like, you know, do we need some type of law enforcement? I'm sure, absolutely. But what we have is so poison and so bad. And it's a tradition of, like, racism. Like, it's just, it's like a cancer. And I don't really see, I just don't receive reform as an option. And what I don't know, which you probably can speak to way better than me, is there any example of a community that has underwent reform and that can be like a model for the rest of America?
I mean, the example that people always throw out, and I'm not, you know, I don't have the on the ground knowledge to really know how true this is, but one of the examples that people throw out is Cincinnati and kind of, you know, greater community control over the police. And I think they may have been doing surveys or something like that of that type, where they were supposed to be kind of using more systematic methods of engagement, I think, in the wake of a consent decree. But that's the example people throw out. I mean, I don't know. I will say, in part because of what I was mentioning with Commissioner Batts and the attention he was getting around reform, I am generally skeptical of how much we as outsiders can, like, of any community can really know about whether a reform is working or not. Because it's always like, working for what? You know? So, like what's the specific outcome variable? And so I wouldn't say that we have a lot of great examples of places overcoming their history. AK Rambo edition, not like a
circumcision, giving nothing more problems than a mathematician playing as a world. So what do we have to look forward to? I'm speaking as a person that I live in East Baltimore. I work in New York, but then I also teach at, I'm a professor in Baltimore City. But as a resident, like police officers, a lot of them, they already know who I am and what I do, so they're not going to bother me. But, you know, my neighbor, he shit out of luck. Like, what does he really have to look forward to?
I guess I'm not convinced that we've actually tried everything yet. You know, it's like, as y'all were talking about earlier, and as Marshall was talking about, in all these commissions, there's always the same diagnosis and the same set of solutions, and we don't do them. And I think that we actually don't do them. Like, I think we create a commission or like we do some sort of policy, but it's not practiced to its full. So, I mean, you even see this in the case of, you know, diversification of police departments, which people talk about is so great, but we see that many times the officers doing, kind of creating additional problems are themselves members of racial minority groups. So then we say, well, diversification doesn't work, but have we really tried true diversification? Have we tried, you know, bringing in people to the police force who have real affinity and real experience in the communities where they work? How we've tried actually creating a critical mass of various racial minority groups within forces that have power to dictate what the departments do. I don't think we've done a lot of that actually. So I guess, and maybe this is totally unsatisfactory, but I'm just like, well, you know, we've done quote unquote reform, but have we ever actually done reform? No.
Hell no. The answer is hell no. Like, it's Wesley, anybody, Marsha, what do you think the answer is? Because right now, what they're doing is not working.
No, I mean, Dee, I think that, I think a big part of this, and I think no matter what the solutions, we hear a lot of things thrown out, a lot of people theorizing, but I think the reality is one of the reasons these things fail is because we refuse to accept the scope and the depth of this problem, right? People think like if only these officers had gone to like an extra day of sensitivity training, there would be no problems in policing all of a sudden. Like the reality is, like we're talking about like the legacy of white supremacy and slavery in the United States of America and its intersections with our government, right? You know, and so I feel like there's a whole there's just a depth here that very often well-intentioned people who want reform can't even begin to comprehend, right? That you've got whole communities, neighborhoods, places like where I grew up in and where others have, where you just don't have any semblance of trust or desire to even trust, and rightfully so because of the history of experiences, right? This isn't about even just hiring a few new officers, because you could put good officers in a bad system and it's not going to change anything, right? It's about fundamentally changing and rethinking the idea of what is policing in the world in which we live in. It was mentioned earlier, the idea of many of the situations in which we insert police officers, undertrained man with a gun is definitely probably not the person who's going to help deal with your dispute with your mentally ill son, right? Or with, you know, so I think that there's just a real, we have to think much more creatively in a much bigger way about what this really means. I mean, there's questions about even, you know, do we need as many police departments as we have? Is that part of the issue? Should we have a conversation even about federalizing the police? Should there be some federal standard or some, and I think that until we're willing to have those types of conversations that are really big about how we change policing across the board, I think it's going to be really difficult for us to actually, you know, implement things that in a macro way change experiences for the millions of people who currently are having such negative experiences with their police.
And I just want to weigh in and say, you know, we need to change police culture. We need to change how police departments are structured, but we also need to change laws that they're enforcing, right? We look at a case like Eric Garner and, you know, Philando Castile, and you look at those cases and think back to, you know, some of the movement we've seen across the states on issues like fines and fees that are really just discriminatory laws that give police a reason to harass people who are out there and give them a reason to even be entering into conversations with them. Many of those conversations which end up in a arrest or in an abusive situation.
And I would just add that one of the things that's very easy for us who think about this issue and talk about it a lot is to overestimate the willingness to even kind of join this conversation or even hint at it. I was talking to a very nice police officer once about
being afraid of the police, and he was like surprised. And he said, well, why would you be afraid of the police? And I think he actually meant that question, and it was shocking to me. And I said, so I gave him this example. I was with a Muslim friend of mine. We were eating dinner, and we walked out of a restaurant, and a police car came up really fast right in front of us and like parked the car like they do in movies, like they're about to jump out. And we were both so scared, and the dude was just going to go to Subway for a sandwich. And I use that example to say is that that was a really irresponsible behavior, that perhaps the police officer didn't realize just how scary he was. But in that moment, both of us were prepared for something terrible to happen. And so if that kind of like peripheral contact can invoke so much fear in two adults, that scale alone is something that we can't take lightly. And so when officers, sometimes they're feigning innocence, but I think that there's a critical mass in this country that doesn't understand that there are a lot of us who feel constantly afraid and under assault and attacked, and that that fear is going to motivate a series of behaviors, and that we are at a point in this country that we can't even acknowledge that that's scary, that I'm going to say this on this show and some trolls are going to slip in somewhere and call me all sorts of names because of that fact. So how are we even going to get to the white supremacy? And so I think that the thing that we have available to us is the capacity for us to really just speak this truth. And it makes me seem small, but I mean, I don't know what else we can do, because you just want to pull your hair out, because acknowledging even that kind of basic level has been such a struggle.
Trolls are just going to be trolls. Like, these aren't people that, these aren't people that solve problems. That's why I just really, 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 really want us to tackle some of these issues. And Jessica, feel free to jump in whenever you want to. But I really, really, really want us to tackle these issues in a way that can lead to quantifiable goals, things that we can actually see and touch and feel versus just getting caught up in the same things that I've said over and over again.
I'll hop in here in terms of reforms that we can actually see and touch and feel. Let's just start with a very basic one. Let's start with not taking away people's driver's licenses when they owe fines and fees or have committed smaller offenses, such as drug possessions. Most people in this country depend on their vehicle as the way to get to work, to pick up their children, to take their kids to places they need to go, to get to the doctor. Taking away their ability to legally drive and creating an opportunity for them to engage with police officers in a negative way, especially over a consequence that has had no rational relationship to, you know, the offense that they've committed, if it is an offense. Sometimes it's just being too poor to actually pay a fine or a fee. But creating an opportunity for there to be a negative police interaction and for police to have an altercation or brutalize them, that's just one quick way that we can take that opportunity away and actually start addressing people as humans and understanding that people do make mistakes or bad decisions, but we don't have to take away their right to provide for themselves, provide for their families, live a normal life, or expose them to any additional consequences that might come from driving without a license.
Yeah, I never really understood that. In general, like, we're going to take away your license because of, like, child support. Especially, you know, some of these cities have such poor public transportation that, you know, you can't get to work if you don't have a car. Or if you get caught on the street without an ID, you can go to jail, which is going to make it even harder for you to find employment. As Baltimore being a topic, Baltimore has the worst public transportation in the world. No disrespect to the bus drivers, but our subway, we got, like three stops. You know what I'm saying? It's like downtown North Avenue and Owens Mills or something. So, like, public transportation is horrible. If a person can't pay child support or get some type of fine where they lose their license, now you can't, you know, public transportation is not going to get you to work. So now you can't really drive to work to actually make the money to pay the child support. And if you get caught on the street without their ID, then you can go to jail.
Or even just a minor drug offense. How does it make sense to take away somebody's license? What if they need their license to get to the program that they're going to get rehabilitation and get off drugs in the first place? There's so many ways in which police can enter our lives every day and have these type of interactions. And I'll tell you, you know, it falls on the local communities. You don't see local city councils or mayors in more affluent areas, which are predominantly Caucasian areas, saying, go after everybody, write tickets to everybody. You see them calling up the police instead and saying, hey, my friend got a ticket. Can you take care of this? And that really does set the culture, because then police are discouraged from giving tickets and interacting with the public and pulling them over in those areas. So I think that we need to start looking at some of the laws and some of the policies that we have. I know there are some municipalities, I believe Ferguson was one of them, where the municipalities actually depend on revenue from fines and fees to support their city. I think in Ferguson, it was as much as 10% of the city's revenue was dependent on police officers writing tickets for fines and fees and people paying them, which, of course, if they can't pay them, they then get a warrant. And at Cup 50, we've gotten all sorts of horror stories coming through during our fines and fees campaign about people who were unable to pay very basic tickets. I believe one was as basic as having gotten a ticket for smoking in front of a minor child. And the parent was unable to pay it, and as a result was arrested on a warrant. During the same arrest, their partner, the minor child's other parent, was also arrested, and both were taken to jail for over 2 weeks, during which that child was in foster care. So just looking at the laws that we have out there and the ways that we're punishing people who are too poor to pay fines and fees is one step in the right direction.
That's what I'm saying. You know, you got these police officers out here, and somebody's telling them to go out and write these tickets, because if you don't, our city's not going to be able to function. That's the reality. So, like, how do you even begin to combat that? We know how much police officers hate writing reports. They don't like writing reports, you know, but they have to, because they got to raise that money. They got to write them tickets. They got to find those people so that the city can function. So I guess when I talk about the whole idea of, like, getting rid of the police department, I guess we should probably have, like, a separate little conversation where I just lay down. I'm going to turn into, like, a phony politician and get, like, a 10-point plan. Mm-hmm. I know one of my plans was, I think that police officers should have to volunteer for like 10 to 15 years before they can actually get the job. So if you want to be
a hero. Well, that sounds crazy, but you know, we expect that of firefighters. A lot of the time, firefighters begin as volunteers and then become trainees and get trained up until they come into the service. So I don't think that's a crazy suggestion that you actually have to volunteer in the community.
DWAC is 2020. You can vote for me.
I don't think we can do any of these things. We have to raise taxes. And this is why Chatelain 2020 will die, as will Watkins 2020 is not going to make it. Because this is the thing. Like, we're financing too much inequality on the backs of poor people. And so, honestly, some of this is about white supremacy. And white supremacy is fueled by financial inequality. And so I think that some of these things, we might not get it until we destroy white supremacy. But there's a whole chunk of this that has to do with detangling financial resources for on the local level from the suffering of others. And so it might be we need to put a few more dollars in the pot to get better outcomes for more people and to equalize resources.
Because it's all about power, right? Absolutely. I mean, you know, the people who are getting the tickets who have to pay them are poor people and Black people in high poverty neighborhoods. But their police officers have incentives not to enforce those same rules in other communities and, you know, people who could pay the tickets. So it's like you either have to raise taxes or maybe you also have to equalize the experience of policing. At the end of the day, police officers know who has power over them and who, and I'm going to say officers when I actually mean departments, because again, like this is a structural leadership sort of problem, but people know whose voices are important. And so I think we have to fundamentally upend that. So one of the interventions I think is really important is real deep community control over police officers and what they prioritize and what they do. And there are a number of different types of ways of getting at that, but that's, I think, going to be fundamental. If we don't just abolish the police, if we keep them around, we have to shift the power structure.
So I'm going to jump in here and say, I don't think that we need to raise taxes, but I think we need to spend that money better. Currently, we spend $80 billion a year to lock up 2.2 million people in this country. In California, we have the sixth largest economy in the entire world, yet we're spending $75,000 per person to lock up hundreds of thousands of people here, and we're unable to use that money that would otherwise be used for crime prevention or for education or for community relations or for financing other things, so that we don't rely on tickets and other fines and fees that, like you said, Marcia, are really just financing government off of the backs of poor people. So I think it's not necessarily that we don't have the resources. It's that we're misspending them to lock people up who could otherwise be contributing to our communities.
I'm going
to
give everybody a chance to say anything in closing. I'll just go right down the list. Marcia?
I guess the last thing I would say is that, you know, pay attention to history. I always say that when I'm on the show. And really try to disrupt the kind of story that you're told, and, you know, read good people who are writing from various perspectives in these moments, because I think that when there is a moment where there's tension and there are uprisings in American cities, and I don't think Baltimore will be the last, you know, in our times, it's really important to spend some time really thinking about what people are angry about. One of the things that I think it's also important to remember is that people were out with signs that say, "Get well, Freddie Gray." And then a few days later, they had to say, "Rest in peace, Freddie Gray." And once we lose sight of that, we lose our ability to really respond to the things that people are asking for.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Marcia Chatlin. Where can they find you at?
You can find me on Twitter at Dr. M. Chatlin, Chatelain.
And Wesley?
Of course. Well, first of all, thanks for having me for this conversation. I think it's been really awesome. I've loved just kind of sitting and listening to a bunch of smart people talk about, you know, something I pay really close attention to. You know, I do think that, to retread a little bit on something I said earlier, I think a big part of this conversation has to be about our willingness to really think big and really think about what is the role of police in our society and how might that need to change for us to build the world in which people are not being killed by the police, right? Beyond that, though, I also think that we have to remember, especially as we talk about media coverage and as we talk about how we perceive these incidents and then the unrest that follows them, is that, as someone else had mentioned this, that so often when we, especially when we talk about violence, when we worry about rioting or unrest or whatever word we use, we lose sight of the fact that the violence began with the police, right? The first violent act in Baltimore was the death of Freddie Gray. Right. Not the CBS, not someone smashing a police car, but it was the death of Freddie Gray. Right. The first violent act in Ferguson, Missouri was the death of Michael Brown. Right. And that, and I think that that's just something we have to remember and we have to consider. We have to keep thinking about how our communities are traumatized with violence over and over and over again, and then how we, as relatively privileged people, can begin to look down on those communities when they respond in kind. And so I just think it's something we have to think about as we're trying to understand and move forward, you know, to, again, to build a world where this isn't something we have to talk about anymore.
Thank you. And what can we find you at, Wesley?
I'm everywhere, and it's all at Wesley Lowry, WesleyLowery on Twitter, on Facebook, on everywhere.
Great. Thank you. And Dr. Monica Bell.
Not a doctor yet.
Almost a doctor, Monica Bell.
No, but thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of this conversation. This issue and the city and the young people there, I care deeply about. And I think that's my kind of my parting thought. I mean, so often the people who we're having these conversations about don't really get to speak for themselves. And even though I do it in an academic context and not in a journalistic context, I guess what I view the work as kind of making sure that the narratives of young people who are affected by these issues come through, and they often say things that are totally missing from the public discourse. And so I think, you know, having real on the ground experience as much as possible, people should prioritize that. The other kind of big takeaway is that this isn't just about specific bad police officers. I've mentioned that a few times, and that's the thing as a sociologist that I'm really concerned about. We look at specific incidents and, you know, pay attention to micro-level stories in order to see where we could be making real deep policy improvements, and not just policy improvements, practice improvements, like deeper improvements. And I worry often that we psychologize these problems instead of structuralizing them, so to speak. And so, you know, I hope that as the discourse moves forward, we keep in mind that we're just observing symptoms of much deeper issues.
Okay, I can make you a title if you want that encompasses all. We'll call you a acajournalist.
No, I'll deal with that.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. And tell everyone where we can find you at on all forms of social media.
I'm Monica C. Bell. I'm Monica C. Bell on Twitter and on Facebook, et cetera.
Yeah, and finally, from our new favorite mayor, Jessica Jackson Salone.
Well, thank you. I don't think I've ever been called a favorite mayor before. I just want to continue to push for both systemic change and local solutions to move forward at the same time. We really need to be addressing this as a systemic problem, both police brutality and community relations and mass incarceration and who we're locking up all go hand in hand. We need to be putting pressure on our local government boards, whether that's your county supervisor, your city councils, your local mayors, as well as putting pressure on our state legislators to reform laws so that we're very conscientious about what we're asking police to do in our communities. If we're asking them to be mental health providers, if we're asking them to show up in custody situations and family domestic situations, if we're asking them to help treat addiction, if we're asking them to help enforce laws that are discriminatory, we need to make sure that what we're asking them to do is very clear and that it's not going to have a disparate impact and that it's not going to be misconstrued to put some people in prison, some people in graveyards, and let some people go scot-free.
Thank you. And where can everyone find you at and keep up with you?
So I'd ask that people follow hashtag Cut50 on Twitter and Facebook. That's the nonprofit I run with Van Jones, where we're working every day to find good laws that will have a less discriminatory impact on them.
Thank you. And I guess I would just like to say to police officers is to just be nice. Treat the citizens like you would treat your kids. Unless you oppress and beat your kids, then don't do that. But treat the citizens the same way you would treat infants. I would say that. Thank you so much for joining me. A reminder to fans, you can participate in the social media discussion using the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda using the hashtag UDAddendum. And follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at undisclosed. POD. Thank you and have a great day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum alongside super producer Methil Telhan. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. And you know this because I say it every week. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, episode 15. Until then.